Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR20. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
The Supreme Court has a decision to make. The court has heard three cases dealing with transgender employment rights and LGBTQ employment rights, and no one knows how they're going to decide it. It's very difficult to tell, even when we know what kind of questions the justices are asking, and we know the general lay of the land on this court, there are still some question marks. Joining us to talk about the Supreme Court and LGBTQ employment rights, Luke Goodrich, attorney for the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty and author of a forthcoming book, Free to Believe: The Battle Over Religious Liberty in America. Luke, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you so much for having me.
What kind of concerns did the justices on both sides express when they were questioning those arguing both sides of these cases?
And this case raises huge, huge issues of concern to all Americans. The justices asked a lot of questions about statutory interpretation, about deference to Congress. They also asked some really important questions about religious freedom. And so I think it's a really key case that presents some hard issues.
There are three cases in play here. Tell us about each one of them.
Yeah, so the three cases all center around the same issue. The facts of the cases, interestingly, aren't all that important. It's the legal issues. And there are two legal issues. Number one, does our federal employment law prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation? And number two, does it prohibit discrimination based on gender identity? So, you know, federal law in this country, it prohibits employment discrimination on various grounds like race, sex, age, and so forth. But this question is about whether employers can be punished if they fire an employee because of sexual orientation or gender identity.
How does Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 come into play here?
So Title VII, this is a landmark civil rights law enacted in 1964, and the original language of the law prohibits discrimination in employment based on sex. So in these cases, the employees, they're LGBT employees who lost their jobs, are claiming that when you fire somebody because of his sexual orientation or gender identity, that is actually a form of discrimination based on sex and should be prohibited.
So, in effect, are the justices being asked to, by their decision, to either equate sex with gender identity or to make a distinction between sex and gender identity?
In effect, they're being asked to expand the original meaning and intent of Title VII, because obviously in 1964, Congress wasn't thinking about protecting LGBT employees. But the justices are being asked in this case to basically broaden the application of the statute, update it for, you know, quote unquote, modern times, and cover new types of lawsuits under Title VII. And that has huge implications for employees across the country, and especially it has implications for religious organizations.
So really, they're not being asked to decide the circumstances of these cases per se, but how that provision in the law ought to be applied by the courts.
Exactly. And, you know, one side of the case, the plaintiff employees, they say that sex discrimination means just taking sex into account. And if you fire a male who's attracted to a male, but don't fire females who are attracted to males, well, you're taking sex into account. And so that's discrimination based on sex. That's the plaintiff's argument. And then the employers come back and say, well, you know, discrimination doesn't mean just taking it into account. It means you actually have to disadvantage someone because of their sex. And if you fire you know, males who are attracted to males, and you fire females who are attracted to females, you may be discriminating based on sexual orientation, but you're not actually disadvantaging males with respect to females or vice versa. So there's no discrimination based on sex.
Can we see, based upon the questions that the various justices were posing when they heard these arguments, can we see where the kind of obvious pro and con decisions are going to be?
It's really hard to read the tea leaves of the questions the justices are asking and make any sort of confident prediction. I think, you know, Justice Gorsuch asked a number of hard questions of both sides, so conventional wisdom is that he might be a swing vote. But even Justice Breyer specifically engaged with the Solicitor General on the issue of religious liberty and seemed to make some suggestions that he might be open to a more traditional interpretation of Title VII as well. So, you know, honestly, it's really anyone's guess about how the justices are actually going to decide the case. And it looks like it may be one that is very closely divided.
How does the issue of religious liberty come into play here, if not, in fact, if then potentially?
So religious liberty is at issue here because there are tens of thousands of religious organizations today that have longstanding beliefs about human sexuality, and they often expect their employees to live in accordance with those beliefs. So, for example, they expect employees to refrain from sex outside traditional male-female marriage, and they expect their employees to live in accordance with their biological sex. And for many years, Title VII has been interpreted in a way that religious organizations are allowed to do that because it doesn't prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. But if the Supreme Court broadens its interpretation of Title VII, all of a sudden, all of these tens of thousands of religious organizations will suddenly be exposed to new lawsuits and new potential liability. And we're already seeing some of this happening. I'm representing a Catholic archdiocese in Indianapolis right now, and the archdiocese has been sued because it had several educators in Catholic schools who entered same-sex marriages, and it declined to give those educators contracts for the coming year. And so those employees are invoking one of the harmful lower court decisions at issue in the Supreme Court right now, and basically suing the archdiocese, alleging discrimination based on sexual orientation. So those are the types of conflicts that religious organizations will increasingly face if the Supreme Court broadens the understanding of Title VII.
I'm curious, because the court obviously cannot write exceptions. It can only decide the case before them. Is this probably why Justice Gorsuch suggested that the court be cautious about overstepping and simply let Congress write laws to address these situations?
That's exactly right. And Chief Justice Roberts brought up this very issue. And it was the issue that my firm, the Beckett Fund, made front and center in our Friend of the Court brief. We pointed out that, you know, when the court resolves these issues, it can only decide the one case in front of it, and it can't broaden Title VII and at the same time protect religious liberty. But if you leave this question to the legislature can consider religious exemptions. It can enact protections for religious organizations. And in fact, 23 states have already broadened their employment laws to protect against sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination. And all 23 of those states have also enacted religious liberty protection. And so Chief Justice Roberts brought up that point specifically and said, you know, what are we supposed to do with this? We as a court can't balance both sides. We can't write new religious protections into the law. So shouldn't we leave this to Congress? And that was a very, very helpful line of questioning.
Are they at liberty to do that? Are they at liberty to say, we're just going to, by what mechanism would the Supreme Court say, we want Congress to decide these things? We are not in a position to do so.
So the mechanism for the court would be to say, look, we know what the word sex in Title VII means and what it meant in 1964. It meant male or female. And what Title VII prohibits is disadvantaging females compared to males or males compared to females. It's not talking about disadvantages based on sexual orientation or gender identity. So it would rule against the plaintiffs in these cases. But then it would be up to Congress, and there are several, there's a bill pending right now that would broaden Title VII in precisely the way these plaintiffs are asking. So Congress would have the opportunity to vote on that, and Congress would also have the opportunity to vote on religious exemptions to protect religious freedom.
What implications would there be? How would you picture a scenario if the court were to decide for the plaintiffs?
If the court decides for the plaintiffs, that means that it would be broadening Title VII to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. And the upshot of that would be a wave of new lawsuits against religious organizations, many of which expect their employees to refrain from sex outside of traditional marriage and expect their employees to present as the gender that they were born as. It doesn't mean the sky will fall and all of these religious organizations will lose, because there are additional protections in the law. There are constitutional protections for religious freedom, and Title VII itself even has something of a religious exemption. The problem is the scope of that constitutional protection and the scope of Title VII's religious exemption are highly contested, and they're very unclear. And so rather than an open and shut case where a religious organization can just say, no, sexual orientation is not protected under Title VII, religious organizations will have to go through very time-consuming and expensive litigation to figure out precisely what their constitutional and statutory protections may be.
Could that mean the court hearing a future case on the religious liberty where the court would be asked to again rule on the scope of those religious protections in Title VII?
Yes, I think you would probably eventually see the Supreme Court needing to weigh in. There are already, lower courts have already diverged both over the constitutional protections for religious organizations and for the religious protections in Title VII. And those issues would eventually, I think, work their way up to the Supreme Court, but it might be quite a few years before the court ended up weighing in, just given how long it can take for these issues to play out in the courts.
What is your feeling for the lower courts when it comes to issues like this? Has there been a trend on how they view the religious liberty and the protections provided either in the Constitution or in Title VII?
Yeah, it's been a mixed bag in the lower courts, but I go into this in great detail in my book, Free to Believe, basically laying out for religious organizations what are the pitfalls when it comes to hiring and firing. And the long and short of it is, when somebody has very clear religious duties within an organization, a pastor, priest, or rabbi, teacher of religion classes at a religious school, the religious organization will have clear constitutional protections in their hiring and firing of religious leaders. And that's because of a 2012 Supreme Court case called Hosanna Tabor, which my firm was privileged to argue, and we won unanimously. But when you go a step down below those high-level religious leaders, maybe the math teacher or a guidance counselor or a church secretary, the law is much less clear on those lower level employees and whether religious organizations can require those employees to adhere to their religious beliefs. And that's where it really matters how religious organizations handle these issues within their organization, both the extent to which they make clear their religious mission, their hiring practices, the caution that they take in their hiring practices, and when they actually enforce their religious standards of conduct, there are certain steps they can take to make it less likely to generate a lawsuit. And those are all kind of practical things that I get into in my book.
So in other words, for the foreseeable future, religious organizations need to be proactive, even at the phase of hiring, in order to make clear their policies and make sure that they are mindful of the potential problems there.
Exactly. Even before hiring, religious organizations need to define their religious mission clearly in their articles of incorporation, in their bylaws, and they need to cultivate support for their religious mission from top to bottom in the organization. And then when they hire, they need to be clear about which positions are critical to their religious mission and lay out those expectations clearly to their employees. They need to cultivate support for their religious mission among employees. And then if they ever do have an issue of discipline with an employee violating church teaching or undermining the organization's mission, they need to act with clarity, with graciousness, with kindness, and still try to treat those employees well, even if the relationship ultimately ends, both because that's what most religious organizations feel themselves called to, is being fair and just and kind to their employees, but also as a matter of wisdom and as a matter of reducing the likelihood of lawsuits and reducing the likelihood of a loss.
Regarding the cases before the court today, do you think that the Supreme Court's Obergefell ruling would have any bearing on these three LGBTQ cases?
I don't think Obergefell will have a direct bearing, but indirectly, Obergefell made clear that even when the court was legalizing same-sex marriage, the court made clear that many religious people hold long-standing beliefs in disagreement with that, and they should still be protected. So to the extent that the court is thinking about the religious liberty issue, the one that Chief Justice Roberts raised, the one that Justice Breyer raised, I think Obergefell will be in the background in terms of we need to make sure that the law does not crush religious dissenters.
Justice Samuel Alito said that if the court decides that Title VII protects gay people, it would effectively be rewriting a law enacted by Congress in a way that was never intended by the lawmakers who passed it. How important should the original intention of those legislatures and the people who elected them be in the minds of the justices deciding these cases?
I think it should be very important, both the original intent, but also just the original meaning. The word sex has a clear meaning, and the word discrimination requires some sort of disadvantage. And so I think both as a matter of original meaning and just a matter of textualism, there are very, very strong arguments for why Title VII shouldn't be expanded. And I think the other thing the justices asked about and will have in their minds as they're writing their opinions is the fact that Congress has many, many times, every year since the 80s, Congress has been asked, a bill has been introduced to expand Title VII in precisely the way that the plaintiffs are asking here, and Congress has never been willing to pull the trigger on that, even when courts were interpreting Title VII narrowly. So I think that, too, will weigh heavily in the justices' decision, as it should, and it will counsel in favor of a narrower and more traditional interpretation of Title VII.
Luke Goodrich is an attorney for the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty and author of the forthcoming book, Free to Believe, The Battle Over Religious Liberty in America. You can purchase Free to Believe and find out more about the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty on the Talk on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Luke, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
When we come back, Terry Mattingly joins us. It's our weekly feature on media coverage of religion. We're going to be talking about the clergy sexual abuse scandal in the Southern Baptist Convention. Then, Joy Pullman is alongside to talk transgenderism in the Illinois public schools.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. thecleaningauthority.com.
Church music directors can find a new community at Prelude to Postlude, the CPH music blog. Learn helpful tips for managing music ministry and involving members, and meet the composers of some of your favorite new pieces. Plus, find suggestions of music to use for special services, and preview some of our newest works with free samples you can use at your church. Visit us at preludetopostlude.org.
Where Christianity meets culture, You're listening to Issues Etc.
What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's a monthly magazine on faith and life, theology and culture that helps readers interpret the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective. Filled with expert insights, good writing, and inspiring stories, it also provides essential church information for LCMS members. What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's the flagship periodical of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and it has been for more than a century. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today.
The Substitute Organist Service, aptly abbreviated SOS, really has come to our rescue.
Pastor Jim Hollowatch of Christ Lutheran Church in Jackson, Mississippi.
With the ever-growing shortage of skilled musicians in our community, we were approaching a real crisis. But thanks to the Substitute Organist Service, help is always just minutes away. With its easy, intuitive interface, friendly customer service, and outstanding musicianship, you really couldn't ask for more.
You can find out more about the Substitute Organist Service at churchmusicsolutions.com.